for members only. Golf Smarter number 401, published on September 10, 2013.
SmarterPodcasts.com. Delivering sound advice.
Intellectually engaged, emotionally disengaged. Dessert with Jim Waldron.
This is Golf Smarter.
Welcome back to Golf Smarter for members only, Jim.
Thank you, Fred. Good to be here.
Still, we're going to wipe
dabbing.
Dabbing on our dinner.
No. Our Thai meal.
Our Thai meal together. The time went on. I want to continue the conversation on yips because I find this so interesting. I'm actually blown away that putting yips are the least prevalent of all yips.
Yeah.
And yet that's what everyone thinks, you know, that when they lift up, when they, you know, mishit a ball, they think that the and it's all on putting, that that's where the yips are. But that's not the case.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, you know, again, if someone, if you ask someone to imagine, put an imaginary ball down there and stroke it to the hole from, say, 6 feet away, and just you could even videotape it and show people what they're actually doing without a ball. It doesn't look too bad. I mean, there might be some particularly mechanical flaws in that stroke, and if I had him do it 10 times, and if it's a truly dominant habit, all 10 strokes will be the flaw will manifest. Mm-hmm. But then I put a ball down there and tape record that, you know, videotape that. It's like all of a sudden all these other new flaws crop up that weren't present when the ball wasn't there.
Right.
So that reacting to the ball thing, the syndrome, that's a flinch. If it's severe, where you can actually see it violently twitch like that, that's just a severe yip. Mm. But if it's much more subtle, that maybe only someone like me who does it for a living would see, that's just what people call a flinch, or it's a mild yip.
And right? it seems to be brought on by the pressure of the game.
The pressure of the game and the fact that the ball is, to the eye of the golfer, particularly a struggling golfer, the ball, it's been commonly reported when people are under competitive pressure, the ball, which is 1.68 inches in diameter, looks like it shrinks down to the size of a marble. And that 4-iron in your hand, used to be a 2-iron when I was a kid, looks like the tip of a butter knife behind the marble. It looks like, and so you're saying to yourself, there is no way I'm going to make solid contact between that little marble and this little tiny club face. And that's where all the tension starts to creep in and the yips start. And it's called being ball bound when your mind is frozen on the ball. That's the term we use, being ball bound.
Well, it's interesting because, you know, when in watching baseball, when a guy is struggling at the plate, you know, a hitter is struggling at the plate, the announcers will frequently refer to the fact that it's the ball looks like the size of a BB.
Yeah,
right?
Exactly. Yeah.
And yet when the guy is hitting well and everything he can hit, it's the size of a beach ball.
Right. Same in golf. Yeah.
Interesting. Interesting. So with all the various pressures that golf elicits, par is probably the worst pressure for anybody.
Right.
Just the fact that that scorecard says you should get a 4 on this hole.
Right.
You should putt. You should only have 2 putts on this hole.
Yeah.
Right. You should be there. It's a 440-yard hole, but you should be there in 2. That would wreak havoc on everybody.
It's the biggest misconception in the game of golf, and I bring this up all the time in my golf schools with average players, which is I literally read from the rule book. There's an actual strict literal definition that the USGA and the RNA have come up with for what par is.
For what par is?
And I'm
fascism.
yeah, exactly. Yeah. Yeah. But par is what an expert player would be expected to score on a day with normal, I'm paraphrasing slightly, normal weather conditions. Expert player meaning someone who does it for like a tour pro. Expert player. Not the average golfer. So if you're a 28 handicap golfer, why would you judge yourself by the standards of an expert and then feel bad about
this
it?
This is like the whole level playing field thing. And again, this is why I think bifurcation is so important.
I do too. I agree with you.
Is that, you know, not only can we not play like them, sure, we can play where they play, but mostly they play on private courses.
Right.
But now we're supposed to play at with their standards.
Which is impossible.
It's impossible.
Yeah.
Even the best country club member pro. I mean, like country club winner, the guy who wins the tournament, right? Ooh, he's a big deal. Well, yeah, that's like a really good college athlete who didn't make it to the pros.
Yep, exactly.
You know, even though the guy is really good and he wins his club championship every year, he couldn't compete on a professional level, most likely, or obviously he'd be there.
Yeah, so if you're around a zero handicap or better, zero plus one plus two, then I would say you probably meet that definition of an expert player. But if you're not a zero handicap or better, why would you be expected to?
How do we get comfortable with the fact that we're doing okay? What is it that we should do for ourselves? Like, here I am, I was down at one point down to an 11. And when I started doing the podcast, I was over an 18, okay? Right. Then I got myself down to an 11.9. And then I did a couple of lessons with someone and worked on some and learned more about my own personal mechanics. Now I'm up to a 14.5, and it seems like I'm more lost. So for someone who's a mid-handicap, 15 handicap like that, what should I be thinking is, I'm doing okay. I'm playing the game pretty well right now. I shouldn't be upset with myself because I haven't broken 80 in 4 years.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I think, if you know, you could just basically multiply your handicap. I mean, add your handicap to 72 if it's a par 72 course. So if you're shooting mid-80s as a 14.5, 15 handicap, that's about what you should be shooting. The thing about golf, though, is in a positive sense, it does sort of, the game sort of by its very nature invites you to want to get better. And I love that about golf.
Yes.
And I always tell my students, until you
there's always room for improvement.
Yeah, exactly.
There's always an opportunity to be better.
And the only way that's going to change is if you stay reasonably healthy. At some point, when you become a senior golfer, it happens to every great player who's ever, amateur and pro, when they reach somewhere around, 60-ish. Maybe 70-ish, if they're really working hard on their health and their flexibility and their core strength and practice a lot, you're going to start scoring worse. It's just inevitable.
It's not the club's fault.
No, it's not the club. And so then you got to find some other reason to play besides having a lower handicap in November than it was in April, right? You got to enjoy the company. You got to enjoy the weather, the beauty, the environment. Or maybe that on one or two holes, you might birdie a couple holes in a row at age 70. I mean, people do it all the time.
Sure.
I think what drives people crazy, though, isn't so much not shooting par on a given hole. Is that what drives golfers crazy, and they come to see me. This is what I do for a living. And people always tell me this. What drives me crazy about golf, Jim, is I can be so horribly inconsistent from day to day and from hole to hole. I can hit the drive. I can hit out there 260 in the middle of the fairway on one hole. And I got a 6-iron in from 160 yards, and it's a big green. The pin's in the middle of the green. Should be easy to hit the green. And I shank it into the water out of bounds or into the trees or something. I mean, and the next hole, I'll do the same thing. It's like
– I call that Ray-Ray golf.
Yeah.
Do you know Ray-Ray golf?
No.
One shot, you hit it like Ray Floyd. The next one, you hit it like Ray Charles.
Oh, that's good. I never heard that one.
And then you hit it like Ray Charles.
Over and over again. Yeah.
It's like Ray good golf. To bad. Yeah. Good to bad. Yeah.
So that's what drives people crazy, because there's nothing else in life where people do experience on a regular basis such an incredible level of inconsistency in their performance that there's literally nothing else you can do as a human being that's going to induce that level of inconsistency.
Right.
So it drives people crazy. They spend a lot of money to try to overcome that issue.
Yeah.
A lot of time.
Yeah.
Some fail to overcome it. A lot of it's picking the right teacher. Assuming you pick a teacher, I don't recommend doing it on your own, because very few people are successful doing it on their own. But if you pick the right teacher and you practice the right information the right way, you can solve that issue to a reasonable level.
But that doesn't mean you're not going to be, you'll be, how do I verbalize this? You may get more consistent in your scoring, but you are still going to have days that are
absolutely.
Not.
Absolutely.
I mean, watch on any given weekend. You can watch a tournament, and a guy will shoot a 65 on Thursday and a 74 on Friday and a 69 on Saturday and an 81 on Sunday.
So there's a certain level of inconsistency in shot making and scoring you have to sort of just accept as an inevitable part of the game. But still have you know, but still be engaged in this journey of never-ending improvement, mm-hmm. so that you enjoy the process at least as much as you enjoy the overall scoring average going down. So, in fact, I would argue it's probably healthier to put more emphasis on the process in the journey, you know, the fun of instruction, the fun of a learning environment, the fun of practicing, the fun of going out by yourself and playing a practice round, not even keeping score. You know, I always say fall in love with the process of in your mind picturing a shot going from where your ball's sitting on the ground to your target and then executing it in actual physical reality. That's the creative part of golf. I call it the art of shot making. If you do that, you're going to score well no matter what.
Yeah.
But if you focus too much on the outcome, which is the score, which is in the future, by the way, because you haven't gotten the score yet, that takes you out of the present moment where all the fun is, all the joy is, right?
So if you, and almost, adds and increases the pressure.
And increases the pressure. And increases the likelihood of flinching.
When we were playing the other day over at Bandon, one of my playing partners asked me for the scorecard, because I was keeping score. Mm-hmm. He asked me for the scorecard as we were approaching the 18th green. I went, no way! The last thing I want you to do is think, oh, if I get a par on this hole, you know, I can break 100 today and abandon you. Thank goodness you can break 100 on those wins. But, you know, it's like, no. You don't want to know that. You don't want to know what your score is going into 18.
Right.
God, no.
Just stay in the moment. Hit one. It's actually, it didn't used to. When I started teaching this way, the way I teach 20 years ago, I didn't know anybody in golf except maybe a little bit. Well, you hear a little bit. I don't think Bob Rotella had yet written a book, but you'd hear a little bit about Rotella talking about this sort of in the grapevine. But I kept saying, stay in the moment, forget about the score, stay in the moment, play one shot at a time. Now, every PGA Tour winner, when they interview him, he or she, or LPGA winner, they say that. So it's now become a cliche, but it's true. It's one of those cliches that happens to be true.
Right, and Dr. Joe Parent, Zen Golf. Sure. It's about the process, not the outcome.
Exactly. So, if you stay in the moment, it's the process is everything. The outcome is really not that important.
But how do you stay in that moment when frustration level is so high? You know, if you're just not having a good day and your tempo starts increasing, the speed of your tempo starts increasing, and your grip pressure starts getting tighter, and your shoulders start getting closer to your ears, right? All these things that are going wrong, and you're not noticing those subtle things, but how do you get yourself to get back
in
the moment?
That's a great question. You know, I work with a lot of people, and I work with a lot of all handicap levels, including professionals. But the people I like to work with the most are guys or gals who are somewhere between like a plus two and maybe a 10 handicap, who in the not too distant past were like a 25 handicap. And they went from a 25 handicap to maybe a seven in say 2 years.
Wow.
Or maybe 3 years.
That's impressive.
Right? And so just think about it. 3 years ago, this guy was a 25 handicap, maybe 2 years ago. And now he's a seven. How did he get there?
Yeah.
That's the guy I talk to a lot, or gal I talk to a lot. And what I found out is that a couple things. They learn to be comfortable with themselves on the golf course, right? Just by playing a lot of golf, playing a lot of rounds. And they learn how to focus their mind on what I call, what I teach is my focal point method, which is to pick one thing to focus your conscious mind attention on from just before you trigger your takeaway all the way to the finish. And never let your mind come off that one thing.
For every shot.
For every shot. And that one thing, that focal point, will prevent you. Basically, it's insurance against flipping. I'm sorry, against flinching. If you have your mind on one thing, you're not going to flinch. But when your mind wanders off or switches from one focal point to a different focal point, that's when your muscles suddenly tightens up.
But did we get to the hardest thing in golf is to clear your mind.
Right.
Is to focus on one thing. Because there's so many different things. Oh, I did that wrong. Yeah. I did this wrong. I should be working on that. I should do this. Yeah. Oh, my wrist was cocked. Yeah. Oh, I didn't, you know.
Yeah, but see, I don't recommend you ever do that. That's trying to give yourself a lesson mid-round or even mid-swing.
Yeah.
Like Hogan, one of my favorite Hogan quotes was Ben Hogan said, the downswing is no time to give yourself a swing lesson. Because the downswing takes a quarter of a second, right?
Yeah.
So if they're a balance point student, they don't do that. They don't engage in swing analysis on the golf course, with very, very few exceptions. They don't.
Isn't it interesting how the better players are the ones who will probably pressure themselves less
Exactly right. Isn't that interesting?
Yeah. I mean, you'd think that, you know, it's like, I'm this good and I want to be bad, but like, you know, and so it's like, I gotta. But yet it's the players that aren't as good that put more pressure on themselves.
And that's partly why they're 30 handicaps instead of seven, because the guy who used to be a 30 and now is a seven figured that out, either from instruction or on his own. He figured out, you know what, if I just can clear my mind and keep it real simple when I'm out there playing, I just have one focal point. Don't try to change my swing. So if I know, for example, here's one way to go from being a 20 to a 7 in a couple of years. If you know you come over the top, I'm not talking severe over the top where you hit like a 40-yard pull, but just, you know, moderate. So you hit like a 15-yard pull, right? Most fairways are around 30 to 40 yards wide. You got room to hit a pull, right? So if you hit a pull that then, say, slices, let's say you hit a pull slice typical that, all right, let's make it simple. Let's just say it's a dead pull. Take the slice out of the equation. So if you pull it 15 yards, you aim at the left side of the fairway. If you don't pull it and it goes straight, right, you're in the middle of the fairway. If for some reason you push it a little bit, you're still in the middle. Now you're in the right edge of the fairway, right? Now, if you pull it more than 50, if you pull it 20 yards, you're in the first cut or
rough. I'm less on pull.
Pull to the left. The ball that goes straight left, where you're aiming.
Okay, yeah, right. That's what I thought. Okay.
So you just
But then what's a pull slice?
A pull slice is where it starts out to the left and then curves to the right.
But that's my ball flight.
Yeah, that's why I brought this up. I saw you do it.
Yeah. Oh.
Yeah. So the point is you play, if it's a manageable miss, if it's manageable, right, not a super bad miss, you can simply stop trying to, I mean, believe it or not, guys who are 30 handicaps often who do have a 15-yard pull will aim at the middle of the fairway. And then if they push it on that shot, which occasionally happens, right, they're going to be, you know, off to the right, right? If they pull at 15 yards, they might be at worst on the first cut of the rough. The point is, you can aim for your miss. Now sometimes you'll aim, you know, if you know you pull the ball to the left 15 yards, then aim at the right edge of the fairway off the tee. Aim for that right edge of the fairway, right? And if you pull at 15 yards, you'll be in the middle of the fairway. If you pull at 30 yards, you'll be in the first cut of rough on the left. Now, if you then push it a lot more than a few yards, you will be in the junk on the right side. So that's why I'm saying if you have a one-way miss, not a two-way miss, right, and you play for that miss. Here's a perfect example. Lee Trevino, I've practiced with him twice for a whole day.
Wow.
And talked to him, and I've watched him several times live in tournaments. I've watched Arnold Palmer a bunch, too. Palmer plays a pull draw, and Trevino plays a push fade. So if Trevino's lining up on a tee shot on the golf course, and let's say the fairway is 30 yards wide, and he intends to have the ball end up in the middle of the fairway, he aims in the first cut of rough on the left side of the fairway. That's where his club face is pointing at setup.
Wow.
But he hits about a 25-degree push off to the right with a little 5 to 10-yard cut on it, little fade. And he does it every club in the bag, pretty much, except maybe his wedges. But, I mean, you know, the medium and longer clubs, he hits that push cut. So he has to aim to the left to account for it. Mm-hmm. And Palmer hits a pull draw, so he aims to the right, hits a pull draw. You don't have to aim exactly. You don't have to have a perfect swing where it's perfectly on plane and aim for exactly at the target. You aim to the left or right of where you want the ball to end up, given whatever your miss is. So it's just smart strategy, right?
Well, I'm so glad to hear that because, you know, I know that I have a fade on my ball, and I've learned to adjust. Today, I'm back nine at Quail Valley. I hit seven fairways. I mean, I hit them all.
Yeah.
Because I'm no...
Sure, you aim off to the left, right?
And I didn't swing hard.
Yeah.
And so I wasn't trying to crush the ball.
Yeah.
So that it's okay to make those adjustments to know what you've got in your bag.
Right. Basically. The other thing is that guy probably has taken fair good chance he's taken quality instruction, learned something about his swing tendency, his swing flaws, probably fixed a bunch of them. So they're no longer there. He put the practice time in to eliminate those flaws. Learn some solid fundamentals, some, you know, maybe grip fundamentals, setup fundamentals, some fundamentals of how the body parts, the moving body parts are performing. And that also can bring your scores down. But it's also that flinching thing we mentioned earlier. They've learned to flinch-proof their swing. I mean, they've learned how to focus their mind, how to be emotionally disengaged while mentally engaged, which is one of our big mottos here at Balance Point.
I love that.
Yeah. Because when you're emotionally engaged, you put stress on yourself, and the stress, the pressure makes you flinch.
Right.
So my whole approach to teaching the playing aspect of the game of golf is use your mind and your emotions so you're decreasing the probability of flinching, right? And you're increasing the probability of not flinching. So there's certain ways you can use your mind, certain ways you can use your emotions that make it almost impossible to flinch.
Mm-hmm.
Like by being emotionally disengaged, which means giving yourself permission to fail. You know, like I mentioned with those shots I hit for you today. I mean, if your ego says to you, oh, I have to hit the target, have to make this putt, you're screwed.
Yeah.
Not going to happen. You're probably going to miss it.
Yeah.
You'll probably miss that 3-foot easy straight-in putt to win the club championships, because now you put yourself in the future where you're holding up the trophy. Right. But, and you haven't even hit the putt yet. So,
but you still want to. How do you? You got to focus on a target. I mean, you know, like
you got to focus on something. It doesn't have to be the target. It can be other things. It has to be something. Target focus is an option. It's not required.
Okay. Because it's putting you too much in the future.
Well, that's one. For some people, about 5% of my students suffer from what we call being target bound. Mm-hmm. If they do focus on a target, their mind gets frozen on the target too much, with too much emotional energy, not just the mental energy, the emotional energy, because the target represents the possibility of both success and failure.
And the target is not the ball. We're not talking about the ball.
The ball is not the target, no. No, the target's where the ball ends up when it's done. Yeah. No, but the point is, sure, most good players that I've interviewed over the years, the most commonly reported focal point for the conscious mind during the swing motion from start to finish is the target. But there have been plenty of tournaments won where people didn't use target. Like,
wow,
people have used grip pressure, feeling how tightly you're holding onto the club is commonly reported. Tied for second most common after target are two things that are closely related, tempo and rhythm. Mm-hmm. So when you talk to a PGA Tour or an LPGA Tour victor, right after the tournament, sometimes their interview, well, what were you focusing on? Oh, my focal point was to stay with my rhythm, or my focal point was my tempo, right? Another one is the finish position, picturing yourself at the finish or remembering what your body feels like, so kinesthetic image at the finish is another common focal point. Balance, particularly balance, sensing your balance in the bottom, in the soles of your feet. You can use that as a focal point.
I tell you, today I had a lot of success because in my pre-shot routine today, I not necessarily added, but I did something today that I don't usually do, and that I would take a couple practice swings with my feet together.
Oh, interesting. Yeah.
Just because sometimes I have a tendency to just come out of my shoes.
Yeah.
Because I'll swing too hard.
Yeah.
So I would swing a little easier and just make sure that with my feet together, I can take some practice swings and stay upright without falling over.
Right.
And that really helped my swing.
Yeah. A lot of what we're talking about, because, you know, I talk about this stuff pretty much all day long with students, but someone asked me like a year ago, well, we just completed a 5-day school. You've got all this wonderful information. What's the most important thing? Which no one had ever asked before until about a year ago.
Wow.
And I thought about it. I thought, you know what the most important thing is? I've since been calling it the imbalance point in our system. I call it the supreme fundamental, and it's awareness. Yeah. If you have awareness, you can learn how to control your thoughts and your emotions. If you don't have awareness, if your mind's on automatic, you know, running out of, kind of spinning out of control, and your emotions are spinning out of control, and you don't know how to calm everything down and have some degree of control over how your psyche is processing information about your feelings, about your bodily sensations, about what your mental thoughts and intentions are, then you are like a machine that's run amok on the golf course when the wheels come off and you hit bad shot or bad shot or bad shot. But the golfer who has some level of mindfulness as to how his mind is working and how his body is working, he has some understanding of what his swing pattern is. Like, how do I set my wrists on the backswing? You know, where do I start? Where do I start to set them? What do my arms do in the backswing? What does my pivot do? And then on the forward swing, what does my pivot do? How do I apply the club to the ball? What do my wrists do in the forward swing? When you have that level of understanding, and you get off a little bit on your timing, maybe, you can kind of get it back, at least most of the time. You can get it back because it's something you're sort of semi-familiar with, right?
Mm-hmm.
But if you're not familiar with your swing, if it's like a foreign entity to you, because either you haven't had enough quality instruction or if you have, you haven't practiced enough off the golf course, then when the swing starts to break down, it breaks down, you know, quite rapidly, and it's tough to get it back.
Right, you know? And then it brings me back to my question, what do we do when things are, you know, how do you stay in the moment? How do you stay present and your awareness being where it's supposed to be when things are falling apart?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
How do you get back to that? What can you suggest that we would do?
Well, usually it starts with your breathing, because when you're under a lot of stress, your breathing can be, people oftentimes hold their breath, or they start breathing rapidly, like a dog on a hot day. Right. Or they start holding breath in between breaths. So they'll tighten up their diaphragm and their throat muscles will tighten up. And so usually there's a proven effective way of reducing some of the stress chemicals in your bloodstream, which is to take very long, slow, deep breaths, like a 10 count on the inhale and like a 15 or 16 count on the exhale.
Wow.
And that slow exhalation basically releases some of the, you know, adrenaline and cortisol from your bloodstream, so you can kind of calm yourself down. But I think it also could help. You have to have a very simple way of playing the game. I mean, the game should be as simple as target there, ball here, ball go to target. Almost like a caveman. You go there. It has to be literally like that simple. Like, ugh, you ball go there to target. It has to be kind of like that, right?
Uh-huh.
If it's any more complicated than that, then
you're doing yourself a disservice.
Yeah, you're going to sabotage your performance. I mean,
wow.
When I play my best rounds at golf, I just have a focal point. I decided before I left the house that day what it was going to be. When I get to the golf course, I write my long game focal point on the scorecard. I write my short game focal point, and I write my putting game, because sometimes there are three different focal points.
Like what?
So, like what?
Yeah, like what?
Well,
what,
for me, the long game could be let's say it's tempo that day, and my short game could be finish. And putting usually is just target, just the rim, you know, the rim of the cup where the ball rolls over. And so every time I write down my score or my partner's score, I see those three focal points to remind me. And I also have a 5-stage pre-shot routine I go through, so I do that the same way every time. And so once I get to the 5th stage, there's an automatic trigger. I start my backswing automatically the same way every time with the same trigger. And it's a physical trigger, not a thought. I don't send over the ball going and just sort of freeze like most high handicappers do and say to myself, okay, any second now, I'm going to start my takeaway. Is it time to start? Is it time to start? I'm looking at my watch right now. Time to start? Okay, I'm going to start now. Good players don't do that. Just like
I've
in the
got
NBA,
a friend. It's like, okay, got my right elbow is twitching, and now at my left, and my shoulders are in line, and he's like takes 45 seconds.
Think
to
of Michael
the club.
Jordan or Karl Malone in the NBA, right? They all had very very precise free throw routines they would go through.
Mm-hmm.
If I remember right,
very disciplined.
Yeah, I mean, Michael would dribble the ball twice. He would pick the ball up then and spin it twice. He would pump once, and he would release. They would do it exactly the same way. In 1 year, he was something like 92% from the line. In that year, every free throw was done with his eyes closed.
Really?
Didn't even look at the target.
Because
he knew where it was. Everything was just on automatic. So you have to have what we call a swing trigger ritual that you go through. So it's the same number of waggles, the same number of target looks.
Mm-hmm.
You could time it down to like a half a second, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's done the same way every time. And then once you've done your trigger, your mind is merging with your focal point, and you have a very fatalistic attitude. In fact, sometimes people ask me, "Well, Jim, why did I hit that shot? Why did that shot slice?" Now, what they're really asking me is, you know, what did I do mechanically wrong?
Right.
But I'm trying to get people away from that kind of thinking on the golf course. And I say, blame it on the Big Bang. Big Bang, what are you talking about?
Yeah.
Big Bang. Everything that happens in the universe, everything that will happen until the universe maybe eventually contracts again, depending which cosmology school you believe in, is because in the first moment of time, there was a huge explosion, right? That's called the Big Bang in physics.
Right.
So everything that happens is the effect of the Big Bang, including your slice that you just hit. To take people off of this constant trying to figure out, analyze why I sliced it, why I hooked it, right? The Big Bang did it.
The Big Bang.
You didn't do it.
It's not your fault.
It's not your fault, exactly.
It's the club's fault. Never blame the club. So some of these things that create havoc for us, possibility of failure.
Yeah.
Tension. God, the list is so long of all the things that are in our minds that have gone wrong before that sure. we don't.
All the negativity. Thank you.
I mean, there are so many things that we don't remember that are positive and that we focus on all the negative things that happen. It's like, wait, but I had a great shot two swings ago. Why can't I remember that and bring that with me?
Yeah.
As opposed to, oh, I chunked it again.
Well, I'll tell you what I do is, and I figured this out maybe, I don't know, 12 years ago. Every shot on a golf course, at the beginning of my routine, I tell myself, this could be the worst six iron from 170 yards you've ever hit. I could shank it into the trees over there and lose a ball. Or I could hold it out. It'll be somewhere in between utter failure and utter success.
Mm-hmm.
Let's find out what happens here in the next few seconds. So I give my permission to hold it out, success, and I give myself permission to fail.
Well, those are two ways. And just recognizing the potential on either side of the spectrum is one thing.
Right.
Giving yourself permission is a very different beast.
Mm-hmm. But I'm telling myself it's okay if I shank it into the trees. I am giving myself, that's what I'm doing. I'm consciously going, it's okay. I'm a good enough recovery shot player. I can hit it out of there if I can find it. If I don't lose it, I can probably hit it out. And at worst, I'll make bogey.
You know, denial is not just a river in Egypt.
I'm actually pretty good from the recovery shots. But so,
well, that's the thing is that that's what you have to have in your bag. You have to have recovery shots. You have to practice different kinds of shots.
But when I do playing lessons with mid to high handicappers, what I find out because I ask them, when you mishit that shot back there, what was going through your mind? They always say stuff like, "Oh, I have to pull the shot off. I have to pull it off." I'm like, no, that's the worst thing you can tell yourself.
Sure.
Never force yourself to have to be successful, right? Actually, that's the second worst thing. The worst thing is to tell yourself, how can I prevent myself from hitting a bad shot? That's the worst way. The second worst is saying, I have to hit a good shot.
Hmm.
I go, take all thoughts of hitting a bad shot and a good shot. You know, once you're over the ball, you shouldn't be thinking about that.
Right.
If you want to think about that, do it like I recommend in the beginning of the routine. You can visualize success, holding it out. You can visualize utter failure. Tell yourself you're okay with either one, right? You know, and hopefully you can fake it if you don't actually believe you are okay. You can kind of fake it, right?
Yeah, and something that I repeat frequently, and we talked about her earlier, Lynn Marriott,
right?
Great instructor out of Arizona. What she taught me was the thought box and the shot box.
Right.
Right? Get behind the ball. Get all the thoughts going. Whatever you need to. Mm-hmm. Clear it out. And then step up to the ball. Mind free. Empty. Nothing.
Yep.
And take your swing.
You just execute.
Yeah.
But you can't execute a free-flowing, fundamentally sound, mechanically sound golf swing with good tempo, with good rhythm, with good balance, if some part of your mind is worried about the outcome of the shot. It just won't happen. Meaning you're going to flinch. Right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Going to write down here, give yourself permission to fail.
Yeah, it's really important.
Or just give yourself permission on either end of the spectrum.
We may have talked about this on another podcast, but I bring this up in every school when myself and the students are discussing about how do you play on a golf course. And I always say, watch the Playing Lessons for the Pros show on the Golf Channel. It's the best instructional show they have by far. And it's usually a tour pro at their home course in the off season, like in October, November, and they talk about what's going through their mind and how they play golf. And it's a revelation on a number of fronts. But
it really is fascinating. I've enjoyed that show.
But the thing I noticed, they're all different personalities, they all different styles of playing, but they all have one thing in common. I mean, it's almost to the point where it's comical because here's what they say. It's always something like this. Well, okay, I got a 3-iron here. It's 220 yards over water and. I played this hole a bunch.
If it's a pro, you know at 220 yards, you're hitting a 6-iron.
Yeah, well, maybe some of the older pros.
Yeah, right.
But they're going, it's my 200-yard club. They're going, but, you know, I've got this sort of thing going on in my neck lately, and I haven't been hitting this club that good. So I might mishit it, but, well, we'll see what happens. And, of course, they stiff it like 2 feet from the hole.
Right.
They do that all the time on that show. They're always making an excuse before they walk up and address the ball. They're always saying, like, well, you know, my swing's been kind of off this week, but we'll see what happens, which is a great attitude to have, right? We'll kind of say la vie.
Really?
We'll see. Yeah, they all watch it. They all say that all the time. In fact, the premier episode was John, you know, John Cook.
But it's like, he's like, are you making excuses before something happens?
Yes.
Yeah. And
it's
people would give a hard
psychology.
Time.
And they're tour pros.
Right.
Major
winners. I mean, like, but if you were playing with someone, they're like, oh, well, you know, I might screw this up. And you're like, oh, yeah, make excuses. You know, money's on the line
but
here.
But it works.
But it's,
it works.
It's really the best
it
strategy
the
to take.
Absolutely.
Wow.
I'll tell you a story about this. John Cook, who I've been a big fan. If you're out there, John, listening, it's Jim here talking, Waldron. I like him. I've talked to him a few times. He's a really, really nice guy. You know, great player. Plays in the senior tour now. The show, when he's on that show, is the best one to watch. You know, at some point toward the end of the show, I think it was on the 15th or 16th tee, he did hit a 3-iron stiff.
Which is not easy to do.
He's talking into the camera the whole time, and then you hear his caddy mumble something in the background, and John goes, what? What? No, you're kidding. How much? I'm 10 under par? He, that day, he broke the course record at his course. He shot something like 10 or 11 under par. And the whole time, he was talking to the camera, to the audience at home.
So
and sort of like talking out loud. He goes, mm-hmm. I should play like this on the PGA Tour. I should call out my shots. I should tell everybody, well, I don't really like this club, but we'll see what it. Because he was starting to realize when he took the pressure off how pure he was hitting it. And it was like a huge epiphany for him on the 16th tee box. After he stiffs it with a 3-iron, he goes, oh, my God, am I really playing this good? He was completely ignoring the score. His caddy was keeping score.
So
isn't that amazing?
It's such an important lesson.
Yeah, it really is.
But what about the idea of, or is this too much pressure on yourself again, to kind of not predict, but this is what I need to accomplish on this shot. I want the ball to have, like, I'm hitting the 9-iron onto the green, and I need to get a nice bit of loft on it, have it land softly, and back up a few inches.
Right.
I mean, to tell yourself, to verbalize.
Yes, you want to do that. That's called mental engagement. We want you to be emotionally disengaged, but mentally engaged. So there's three centers. There's a movement center, which is how your body moves. There's the emotional center, your emotions, and there's your mental center. How you process information, your attitudes, your thought process. So you want to picture the ball going to your target. You want to picture success, always. But you have to tell yourself, but you know what? I don't really give a damn if it's successful or not. That has to be your emotional state. It has to be, I'm okay. It's like Spock in Star Trek. The warp drive is about to explode, Captain. Fascinating. It has to be like that. You have to be so emotional. You know, they call it sports psychology. They call it being neutral. You know, emotional neutrality is good for sports like golf. Because if you get too emotionally engaged, you're going to flinch.
You're going to get amped up. And here we go back to the pressure, the grip, the shoulders, everything.
And this stuff that's
tempo.
Kind of new to golf now has been discussed for over 2,000 years in Asian martial arts tradition. There's been many, many books written about it in China and Japan especially. There's a great book written in 1962 by a Western philosophy professor from University of Heidelberg, Eugene Herigel, and it's called Zen and the Art of Archery. It's a great book. And it's about he spends a year in Japan, in Kyoto, practicing Zen Buddhism and learning martial arts, and particularly Kyudo, which is the Japanese art of archery. And it's about his struggles with some of these concepts we're talking about now, about being emotionally disengaged from being successful and hitting the target. Because he would try really hard, right? And eventually
which creates tension.
He wants to quit because he's just not getting it, right? And so he calls up his teacher, his sensei, and says, sensei, I just can't do this anymore. I've been doing it for like 9 months. I'm still not hitting the bullseye very often. I'm, you know, still missing the target by a mile. And so his teacher says, come meet me at the dojo at midnight. So they go to the dojo, and it's completely dark in there. There's like just a faint little bit of light from the street light coming through the window, but it's basically almost completely dark. He takes the sensei takes the bow. Let's go. They walk. They go up and check. Perfect bullseye. And Mr. Herigel says, well, how can you can't even see it. How do you know where it is? And he gave, you know, he talked about how my mind is empty. There's actually a term in I think it's, what is the term? I think it's muon, in Japanese for empty mind. Hmm. When you empty your mind and let things go, let go of control, good things happen, like hitting the target. And then, of course, he was able to do it right then. He duplicated. It was the first time he I think he had three in a row in the bullseye. And he had stopped trying. He had emotionally disengaged. My first important sensei or, you know, teacher in my life was a guy named Sensei Sugiyama. He was my karate teacher from age 12 to 15. He was just a brilliant martial artist, and he was also a Zen monk. And about 6 months into my training, we would free spar. We would fight. And back then, it was all no contact. And he was so good, he would say, "Get ready, here it comes." He'd say, I'm going to kick your left eyelash with the big toe of my right foot." And I would see a blur, and I would feel a little tick right there. That's talking about controlling your body, right?
Wow.
So anyway, we're fighting one day, and of course, he's like just killing me, right? He's I'm telegraphing all my punches and, really slow compared. He's blindingly fast. He's like Bruce Lee, just blindingly fast, right? And it's been going on for about, a couple months. He'd say, Tumashigo, Tumashigo, Eldrin-san, Tumashigo. I was like, all right, I figured some Zen term or some Japanese. So one day I go, "Sensei, when you're saying Tumashigo to me when we're fighting, that's like a Zen word, right? Like a Japanese, like a Zen term? And what does it mean?" He goes, "Not Japanese, English, too much ego." He was saying Tumashigo. And I thought it was some Japanese, because it sounds like a Japanese word, right? He was saying too much ego, meaning he could see that I was trying to think my way through the positions of blocking, punching, and kicking. I wasn't being reactive to the target. The target was him that I'm trying to hit, right?
Right.
Because I was trying to think my way through it. And so many golfers do that. They try to think their way
through. Too much ego.
Through the positions. They aren't playing the game. When you play the game, you just react, right?
Yeah.
You don't think your way through it. And I tell people, look, if you want to think your way through it, that's for the mirror in slow motion. That's where you want to be thinking when you're standing in front of a mirror, like I did with you today with the slow motion work. That's when you can think. That's when the part of your brain that can think can actually control your muscles and joints and your bones with precision. But when you're moving at normal speeds in any sport, the part of your brain that's controlling your body is the subconscious mind. It's involuntary control, right?
Wait. Oh, yeah.
Can we get a box for that?
Yeah, he wants to take that home. Thank you very much. And do you guys need to close up soon?
Okay.
So, I think that Jim, we're about done then.
I guess so.
We're being kicked out of this.
We closed down the bar.
That's good. Well, listen, man, again, thanks for your time today. I'm so glad that we got to do this. And for every time when I make the call, you're there like, yes, I'm in.
Yeah, I love doing it. It's fun. I enjoy it.
And I really enjoy having you on. You're one of my all-time favorites.
Well, thanks,
buddy.
Pleasure, as always.
Up next, by request from almost everyone, Fred Shoemaker of Extraordinary Golf returns to help us celebrate our 400 episode milestone and to discuss his brand new DVD, The Secret to Transforming Your Game. And we'll talk about how you can get one for yourself in our Golfer Smart at the all new golfsmarter.com. I'm going to say this to our members only right now because I'm not allowed to announce this to the public, but there will be a coupon code listed on the members only site that will allow you to get a member's discount on the DVD. Stay tuned on the next show for that. Now, I have a favor to ask of you. Now, I've not done this before, and knowing how I bombard you with other offers and goodies and contests and all these things, I really was a little reluctant to do this, but I feel this is different. You know, I try to be as transparent as possible on the show, but I've never mentioned that last October, my wife was a pedestrian in a hit-and-run car accident that put her in the hospital for almost a week, and she was out of work for nearly half the year. We're incredibly grateful that it wasn't much worse, and honestly, a millimeter or a millisecond in either direction, and it could have been tragic. Thankfully, she's doing much better now and has gone back to work. And coming up in a few weeks, in early October, I'm going to join her and a team that she's created called the Gratitude Express. And that will be for the annual Breast Cancer Awareness 7-mile hike up Mount Tamalpais in Marin County. Now, I'm sure that you've seen the very iconic photographs of the Golden Gate Bridge that are either placed with a mountain in the background or it's got the San Francisco skyline in the background. Well, that mountain, that's Mount Tamalpais, where we're going to be doing the 7-mile hike. And as we locally know it, Mount Tam. So this year, I'm helping her out and would like to ask you to meet my modest goal of raising only $250. Not per person. You can make any donation that you'd like from a dollar up. I really don't care. Anything would be greatly appreciated. This isn't anything I've requested from the Golf Smarter community before, but we've known each other long enough now that I hope you don't mind the request. Any amount you can provide would be of great help. And of course, we're both incredibly grateful for your support. To make a donation, just click on the Breast Cancer Fund button on the all-new homepage at golfsmarter.com.
SmarterPodcasts.com. Delivering sound advice.